All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Friday. Welcome to the task force for the health IT for the care continuum. We will do a brief roll call, and then we will get started with our meeting. Carolyn Peterson.
I'm here.
Chris Lehman.
Good morning.
We have Aaron Muir yet? Okay, maybe not yet. Steve Waldron.
I'm here.
Great. Chip Hart.
I'm here.
And Sue Kressler. Okay, maybe Sue will join us later. At this point, I will turn it over to one of our co-chairs, Chris Lehman, for a few brief remarks.
Yeah, good morning, and welcome to the call. I'm very excited that we can welcome today some guests from the MITRE Corporation who have worked with AHRQ on a topic that is part of our charge. As you know, opioid use disorder is one of the items that is on the to-do list for this committee, and we will have some presentation and demo today, and we're looking forward to that. And that actually also it suggests that our work is now pivoting a little bit. You know, we've been focusing on a pediatric EHR format and the EHR requirements for pediatrics in the last calls. And while we will still address some of that in this call and future calls, we are now moving to the other agenda items that we have. And with that, I'm just going to turn this back over. Carolyn, did you want to say some words of welcome?
I'm just really excited that we have our guests here today to present the demonstration for us, and I'm really looking forward to it. Welcome.
Thank you.
I
know Chris is working on sharing his screen for the first section of the presentation, which is two PowerPoint slides.
Yes, so it looks like I am not in presenter mode in Adobe Connect anymore. Is there someone who's able to put me back into presenter mode? I had to reconnect.
Hi, Chris. You should be there now.
Okay. I should be there. Okay, here we go. Share my. It looks a little different than last time for some reason. Okay, if someone can confirm that they can see my screen, that would be great.
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So let's begin.
Great. Well, hi, everyone. My name is Sharon Sebastian. I'm a clinical informaticist at the MITRE Corporation. I have a nursing background. I'm also the project lead for CDS Connect. And I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with CDS Connect and the project that's on the phone, so I thought it might be helpful to share just a little bit of background information about the project to provide context for the demo that Chris is going to provide. So the CDS Connect project is sponsored by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality to advance evidence into clinical practice by developing prototype systems and tools that can help with the creating, sharing, and implementing decision support in health IT systems and to make it easier and more accessible for healthcare organizations. The primary system that we developed is the repository, which we call CDS Connect, and it's available on the internet. It's a database that hosts logic, decision support logic, that's publicly available and free to download and use. Right now, there's over 50 artifacts, which is what we call pieces of logic, that are available and free for any organization to access. We also created an authoring tool that eases the development of interoperable standards-based decision support. So each year, we take on a different use case to inform the enhancements of these two systems by developing decision support in a designated domain. And then we go on to partner with a healthcare organization to pilot our decision support so we can document lessons learned, you know, how the artifact performed, how it was enhanced as a result of the integration, testing, and use. And then we share all of that information along with the standards-based code on the repository. So last year, the clinical domain that was selected was pain management and opioid prescribing, and we used the CDC guidelines for prescribing opioids for chronic pain as the evidence-based source that informed the development of the decision support. As you're probably aware, the guidelines include 12 recommendation statements to help providers determine when to prescribe opioids, if they prescribe them, how to do it safely, and then if the patient begins to misuse opioids, how to treat opioid use disorder. When we actually decide what we want to express as decision support, we have a few kind of unique things that we try to consider. So number one, we don't want to overlap with anything, any decision support in that domain that's already publicly available. So we knew the CDC was sponsoring decision support work to express each one of their recommendations as decision support logic. And they were doing kind of a one-to-one correlation. One recommendation expressed as one piece of CDS logic that provided an intervention that was, you know, specific to where that would fall in the workflow. And that work is being kind of co-led by Ken Kawamoto, and I think you're aware of his work, and he may be demoing that sometime in the near future for you. So since we knew that work was going to be publicly available, we didn't want to overlap with that and do a one-to-one kind of translation. The other thing is we want to ensure that whatever we develop can be broadly used by nearly any organization. So for instance, developing some kind of specific PDMP integration and display for a unique pilot site, say in Oregon that uses NextGen, may not be very applicable to an organization in Florida that uses Epic. Or even an organization in Florida that uses NextGen because each implementation can be so different. So finally, we also want to be sure that we develop something that providers want, something that makes things easier for them, that's not already available in most EHRs, and that's feasible to be integrated within the timeline that we have. So we came up with a variety of options and presented them to about 12 different pilot organizations, healthcare organizations. And you can see just a few of our ideas at the bottom of the slide. One of them actually was more closely aligned to ECQM that's in one of CMS's programs, the MIPS program. But what came out as the number one request by every organization that we spoke with was a pain management dashboard that provides a summary view of all the clinical factors that should be considered when managing a patient's pain. And, you know, most EHRs will offer some summary views for really prominent conditions like diabetes or CHF, but none seem to offer one for pain management yet. So we knew we were onto something good. We wanted to do that. And the good news was that we had heard that it would really, as we suspected, reduce the level of effort of a provider having to navigate between the problem list and the med list and lab results and everything to get a full view of the patient's history prior to making the next pain decision. If you go to the next slide, Chris. You can see that the summary is divided into four different sections, and they're listed down the left side of the slide. The first section is the pertinent medical history, and that displays conditions that are in the patient's record that are associated with chronic pain, so things like lower back pain, spinal stenosis, fibromyalgia. In that section, there's also a display of factors that increase the likelihood for harm if an opioid is prescribed to that patient. So that's where substance use disorder, depression, suicide attempts, pregnancy would be listed. And all of those factors come directly from the CDC guidelines. The next section lists pain assessment scores over the past 2 years, and we really would have liked to have included the patient's goal for their pain, but it was not something that our pilot organization and the providers within that organization routinely captured. And unfortunately, that's pretty common across most practices and most EHRs. If it is captured, it's kind of captured as free text. So there's a good amount of work that would need to be done to get that into a structured field to reason over. In the summary, we also include historical treatments that have been ordered or tried in the past 2 years, including medications and non-pharmacologic treatments. And then finally, any evidence of additional considerations that could pose a risk. So things like their MME amount, drug screen results, concurrent use of benzodiazepine, and risk screening assessment scores from things like a PHQ-9 or an opioid risk tool. And there again, you know, we definitely considered a PDMP access or display, whether it was in the risk consideration section or historical treatments, but it just was out of scope for that effort that we did last year. So overall, we designed the summary to be clinician-facing, but during the training, we encouraged clinicians, as they became comfortable with the summary and the views that they were seeing, to consider tilting that screen so the patient could see the summary too, and that way use it as a way to promote shared decision-making and ultimately get the patient's buy-in in the treatment plan. Within the UI of the Smart on Fire summary that you'll see, we did include some contextual flags to highlight areas of concern for the clinician to be sure to notice. But ultimately, the summary itself doesn't make any treatment recommendations based on what's populated in the dashboard. It purely pulls all the information needed for the provider to make the best decision possible. Now I'll turn the mic over to Chris for the display.
Sure. Thank you, Sharon. All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to bring you through a brief demonstration of CDS Connect, as well as the pain management dashboard that Sharon spoke about. So if you're interested, you can go to CDS Connect at cds.arc.gov. Here we actually have a highlighting of several CDS initiatives from ARC, but if we click on CDS Connect, we'll go to the portion that represents our project, CDS Connect. Here you can learn all sorts of different information about the project, so if we piqued your interest and you do want to learn more about how we work, about our governance, about our community, this is the place to do it. We also offer an authoring tool to help to create CDS logic, but we're going to dive right into the artifacts, which is the repository portion of this, which is a collection of CDS artifacts that are all derived from evidence-based standards of care. And they're expressed using international data standards, things like HL7 clinical quality language. So at the top, we have some new things, but I'm actually going to scroll down to the topic of interest for this. So excuse my quick scrolling, which probably doesn't share very well over the internet, but we're going to go right down to opioids and pain management. So here we can see a number of artifacts. The first one we see is the pain management summary, which Sharon was just talking about. But we also have several of the other CDC recommendations, number 4, number 5, number 7, 8, 10, 11. These are the ones that actually CDC contracted out to Ken Kawamoto and Bryn Rhodes and that team. And they are hosted here so that somebody coming to CDS Connect would be aware that they exist. And we'll actually dive into one of those a bit later. But first, we're going to dive right into the pain management summary. So here we go. Here's the pain management summary. Here you can see a basic summary of what the artifact is. On the top right, we actually have some documentation that is very helpful to people who are considering using this artifact. So we provide things like an implementation guide. This tells you about how we implemented the artifact, how we took it from a narrative you know, from the narrative content that's in all of the CDC recommendations and how we worked towards this inspired, CDC-inspired dashboard. We also have a final report of the pilot, which tells you how the pilot went, tells you a bit more about how we integrated at the pilot and things like that. So all sorts of interesting data here. I'm actually going to scroll down a bit further. And here we have some links. I'm going to open these in separate tabs for now, but one is for the Smart on Fire app, the pain management summary in the Smart on Fire gallery, and the other one is the open source code on GitHub, and we'll get to those in a few moments. Continuing to scroll down, we can see that this is a knowledge level 3. So when we talk about CDS, we often talk about 4 knowledge levels, the first being narrative. So this is just the prose that describes what we're trying to do or the guideline. Semi-structured is when we get to the point where we are organizing this in a semi-structured way. So often that's bulleted lists, but it's a way that you can get a better understanding of the logic without having to parse prose. And then structured is when we actually use a standard like CQL or something like that to actually make it so that machines can begin to understand what it's talking about. And then executable is when we actually implement it at a pilot site and make it executable. That might include any site-specific mappings and things like that. So most of the artifacts that we try to publish through CDS Connect happen to be in the level 3 or structured, as is this one. As we scroll down, we can see source and supporting evidence, but I want to show you the level 2 representation of this. So this provides a high-level overview of everything that is in the artifact. We know that the patient must be over 18 or older. We know that in order to display the summary, we're looking for conditions associated with chronic pain or evidence of a pain medication or another medication related to pain. And we can see here all of the high-level data that actually goes into the summary and some of the specific details around that. So this gives you a good high-level overview of what's going on. Here we have a link where you can actually download a standards-compliant version of the artifact. So I'm going to open that and show that to you real quick. My understanding was that you wanted to get a better idea of some of the technology and standards behind how this works, as well as, you know, what are some of the challenges. So this will help to demonstrate that. This is CQL. So it's intended to be an author-friendly language for describing clinical decision support and electronic clinical quality measurement logic. It is fully computable by systems, but again, we try to make it so that it's author-friendly so that you have a chance of looking at it and understanding what's going on. In our case, we're using FHIR as our data model, and FHIR 102 is more commonly known as DSTU2. And we can see here the code systems that we set up, the value sets. So we're using value sets from the National Library of Medicine's Value Set Authority Center. Anybody familiar with electronic clinical quality measurement and CMS's programs there, a lot of this is very similar to how those work as well. And here we set up some codes that we have to use. Now this is actually showing one of the challenges that we face right now, which is that a number of these codes here are actually tagged as local. And what that means is we were not able to find a standardized code for some of these concepts. So we couldn't find a standardized code at the time for PEG, for the PEG scale, or for start back, or for some of these single question things, or MME. And so this represents one area where there's definitely some customization that needs to happen at every integration to make sure that they're providing those local codes since standard codes aren't available. Now we have begun the process of making some of these codes standardized, and in fact, the pain enjoyment general activity or PEG codes were just recently published through LOINC, and so we need to update this artifact now to use those standardized codes. But this points to one of the challenges. But as we get down here, there's lots of code. you probably don't want to see all the code, but here you can get an idea of what's going on by looking at the inclusions. So this is the logic where we say, you know, the patient must be 18 or older. This is where we identify what conditions are that are associated with chronic pain, and we check to see if they exist. Same thing for the opioid pain medications. And we bring those all together, is 18 or older, has conditions associated with chronic pain, into this representation of whether or not the patient meets the inclusion criteria. So really quickly, that's essentially how the CQL works. So what we did was we created CQL, standards-based logic, to represent all the logic in the application itself and the aggregation and collation and organization of the data. So CQL is used to actually pull all the data from the disparate parts of the record and to provide them in a structured way that the pain management summary can then display. And so we'll jump over to the pain management summary now. This is in the Smart App Gallery, and do feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions. Otherwise, I'm just going to keep on plowing through. This is a Smart App Gallery. Here we have a link to click to try app. And when we click that, it's actually going to launch the Smart App for the pain management summary against a synthetic patient named Brenda Jackson. So for those of you who might not be familiar with Smart on Fire, it's essentially a way to allow third-party applications to be launched from an EHR and to be able to call back to the EHR and get the data that they need. And it uses the FHIR standard in order to do that data exchange. So it's a great way to be able to extend an EHR's capabilities without having to do any proprietary work in the EHR, without having to actually modify the EHR code itself. And it's all standards-based. So this is the pain management summary. We can see at the top, we have Brenda Jackson. She's 62. She's a female. On the left-hand side, we can see our navigational aids to get through some of those sections that Sharon talked about. Now, one limitation that you'll see here is we have a big banner that says, take notice, this summary is not intended for patients who are undergoing end-of-life care or active cancer treatment. When we were working with the pilot organization, we discovered that when you're talking about a primary care office, these concepts, end-of-life care and active cancer treatment, can be difficult to accurately detect. Often the primary care office might not have any records that would indicate whether there's hospice or palliative care, or that would necessarily indicate the active cancer treatments that the patient is receiving. That doesn't always make it all the way into the primary care EHR. And since we couldn't really reliably get that data, what we chose to do was to put this notice up and say, you know, hey, clinician, as you're reading this, keep in mind, if your patient meets this criteria, end-of-life active cancer treatment, this isn't really designed for your patient. We'd love to do that. Again, we'd love to do that in a standards-based electronic way, but we're just not at the point where that's possible yet. So scrolling down, we can see our conditions associated with chronic pain. We can see that this synthetic patient has fibromyalgia, lumbar post-laminectomy syndrome, lower back pain. We can see a status, a start date, some important things around that information. This is all getting pulled from, you know, probably from the problem list, but it's using a FHIR condition query. But we're also looking in the encounters for encounter diagnoses. Several of the risk factors for opioid-related harms would more likely be found as an encounter diagnosis than necessarily something on the problem list. If I click on this More Info button, I actually can see a list of the types of things that we're looking for as risk factors. So this is where we see the depression, anxiety, substance use disorder, suicide attempt, etc. So this is a way that the clinician can actually get more insight into what's being displayed. And for this particular patient, out of all of those, the only thing that's relevant in her record was the depression. Scrolling down, we have the pain assessments. And one challenge that we ran into here is that systems that use Argonaut, which is, you know, the most popular flavor of FHIR in implemented systems today, Argonaut for what we call observations in fire. Argonaut only defines vital signs, lab results, and smoking history. It does not define assessments. So when we went looking for the FACES scale or PEG scales or anything like that through the fire API at our pilot site, those weren't available because they're not explicitly defined by Argonaut, and so they were apparently lower priority to implement. This was an Epic system, but I don't think, you know, I think you'll find this across the board for many EHRs. If it's not specifically defined by Argonaut, there's a good chance it's not going to be there. And so we had to actually do some custom work at the pilot site in order to expose these pain assessments and other assessments like PHQ-9 and things like that. In order to expose them through the FHIR API, there was some custom work that was needed. It did not come out of the box. Scrolling down, this is where we can see historical pain-related treatments, our opioid medications, our non-opioid medications, our non-pharmacologic treatments. So this is where we can see a patient referral for psychotherapy. This is, again, something that we had trouble with at the pilot site. Getting procedures or evidence of procedures that happened, you know, outside of the primary care office was difficult. If we had referrals in the system, it was nearly impossible to determine whether or not that referral was ever followed up on. So, you know, the closing the loop issue still was a problem there. But we did our best to show what we could.
Chris, this is Sam. I'm just mindful that you have a hard stop at 9:30 and it's 9:28. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Okay. I think I'm almost done here. Thank you very much. So the last bit is the risk considerations, and here we see the MME, and I know that this was something that was of interest to the group, and we are displaying MME in the pain management summary. And this particular patient has a very high MME. We actually flag that. Whenever you see these little red exclamation points, that's saying, hey, this is something you want to look at. So in this case, MME is well above 50, and so we flag it. Now, one important note is that we are not calculating the MME in this application. We are expecting the MME to be provided to us as a value. So at the pilot organization, they were using Epic, and they were in the process of integrating a capability where Epic could calculate the MME for them and provide a value. And in that case, you know, we would be able to query what is the MME and get back a value. But I do want to make it very clear that we were not calculating that ourselves. We were depending on the EHR logic to do it. And I believe that that capability actually turned on partially through our pilot. It wasn't ready at the beginning of the pilot, but partially through the built-in EHR capability for MME was turned on. But we still, there were still lots of questions and some struggling with the results trying to understand them. So another challenge. Urine drug screens would show up here. We flag this because there aren't any entries shown, and we think that, you know, based on the guidance in CDC, that it's good to have some urine drug screens, benzodiazepine, naloxone, and then risk screenings relevant to pain management. So this is the pain management summary as it shows here. If you were interested in actually implementing this in your own system, it is all open source code. It's available on GitHub. It's linked from the CDS Connect website. We use the Smart on Fire JavaScript client library. We use an open source library for executing CQL, and it's all here with instructions on how you can launch it. So the last thing I wanted to show you, and I know we're pretty much out of time here, but I'll just show you really quickly is, again, if you go to the CDS Connect and you go to any of these other recommendations here, say the lowest effective dose, these are the things that Ken and his team have been working on. And there's actually links to their full implementation guide, which provides a lot more information. And one thing I did want to draw your attention to, because it was brought up previously, is that Ken and team did actually implement CQL to calculate MME. It wasn't ready on time for us to do our pilot, but they have implemented that. So if you really are interested in how you can calculate MME using standards-based logic, then I think that's something that that Ken would be able to show you. Or if you go through to this IG, you can actually find the CQL that does it. There are some limitations there. It can only calculate MME for the medications that it has access to and that it's aware of. And if you don't have something like PDMP support, then you know, you're potentially doing the calculation over incomplete data. But hopefully Ken will be able to come and demonstrate some of the great work that he's doing with this and with CDS hooks so that you can get more insight into that as well. And that's it.
Thank you very much, Chris. We appreciate the demo. I have a couple of questions. So the use of this particular tool that you just demoed to us, where in the workflow for a practicing clinician would that happen?
So our expectation was that this would happen at the point of care while a patient is in the office with the clinician, and particularly if the patient is experiencing pain and the clinician and the patient need to make a decision about how to manage that pain. So that's essentially, you know, we were anticipating that is when it would happen, at the point of care, when decisions about management of pain need to be made, or maybe even when revisiting with a patient who's already, you know, has some therapies in place, but you want to review how those therapies are working, or you want to assess whether you should make any changes.
And so, likely after an assessment has been performed.
Okay. So my experience is that things in the EHR are only used if it's tied to some kind of incentive or reimbursement. Is there currently anything that would incentivize a physician to use this tool?
Not to our knowledge. There are some pain management ECQMs in the works being analyzed, but it's mostly the ability to cut down on all of the surfing across the EHR to get the information they need. So
sure.
Hopefully using this is just reducing their effort at helping them, which is the incentive.
I mean, it's a lovely dashboard that aggregates all the necessary information. But, you know, like I said, I only see people use things that they ultimately can drop a bill for. So that's what I'm concerned about. I love the fact that you there will be a central tool to calculate the morphine milliequivalent dose, because I think there's no need for everybody to reinvent the wheel if a new medication comes on the market that has a different conversion factor. So I think that's an excellent future development there.
If I can say one more thing,
yeah.
Feedback that we got from the physicians using the tool was that they tended to use it for really complex patients that had a lot of pain, and they had tried a number of things. That's when they really went searching for it. If it was a simpler case, they did not.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought this is for your patient who is seeing multiple specialists, who might be getting some opioids from a neurologist as well as from his PMD, who has a history of multiple diseases and comorbid conditions. That's where it makes sense, because it reduces your cognitive load significantly.
Any additional questions?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Any comments, anything that anybody else on the call wants to say?
Yeah, this is Chip Hart. I'm always interested in, because we're so pediatric focused here, I'm always interested in the pediatric specific clinical decision support. I mean, you gave your example inadvertently when we were looking at the logic in the background, and you know, it says if patient is over 18, And I was poking around the Fire app myself, you know, just before you got to it. And it's really targeting an audience that doesn't, that isn't what we're looking at here. Just in terms of pediatricians are always looking for better clinical decision support because everything starts with on the adult side. So when it comes to applying anything we learn here, we've got to boil off everything that's adult focused. And any way that we could get a summary of what very specifically is pediatric is going to be a big advantage, I think.
I hear you on that. And because we took a more generalistic view of just compiling information, we really were hoping to lower the age limit, to make it any age. But in directly aligning to the CDC guidelines, they specifically cite it's for adults 18 or older. And because we added those contextual flags that were aligned to CDC recommendations, it was preferred that we stick to their, you know, directly to their guidelines. But I think there is absolutely a use for children who are younger. You just might need to look for additional evidence that might, you know, be more specific for their age for some of the UI flags.
Yeah, and I will mention that, you know, it's not relevant to this conversation about opioids, but there are some artifacts in our repository that are based on pediatrics. We've received some contributions from CHOP, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And so there are a few things out there for you, although admittedly not very many.
Yeah, that's it. It just boils down to that. I mean, I totally understand where and why you built this and what you targeted for. It makes all the sense in the world. It's just, and with good reason, pediatrics is a bit of an afterthought here. But as we're all learning, this is where a lot of the opioid dependence starts now. And if we could, you know, Dr. Lehman, I'm saying this to you, since it's our goal to leverage the pediatric side of this, if we could look at some of these things and figure out, okay, what does an actual, ambulatory pediatrician need? What is the one thing that they need to get them to pay attention to this? Because we're not generally talking about a patient with a massive history here that they're looking at every day. Anything we can do to go down that path, I think, is very much worthwhile.
I think for the pediatric side Chip, we are more interested in the child with neonatal abstinence syndrome, not the person who's actually taking the opioids. So this doesn't quite fit the pediatric bucket, as you pointed out. I just have one more question. A more common, just from a design point of view, I think flagging a high MME the same way as you flagged absence of data is probably not, from a design point, not the best. I would consider revising that just as a friendly suggestion.
This is Steve Waldron. I was going to mention the same thing, Chris. One question I have, or maybe it's more kind of a comment too, but you mentioned that as you create these CDS modules, that they're kind of based on one recommendation from the CDC. So you have a collection of those that are, then I'm assuming, are each independent. So how do you handle the interdependencies? So, for example, the MME. So if I had the CDS connect for Ken Rubin's calculation and yours for the summary, how does the system know to call Ken's first to create an MME and be able to have that available and then call yours so that yours would have that, where if I called them in reverse order, yours would show that there is no MME?
Sure. So that's a good question. And I think that we have not orchestrated that yet. You could actually... again, Ken's stuff was not available at the time that we implemented this last year, and so we weren't able to integrate it. Had it been, then perhaps we would have written the CQL to directly invoke Ken's MME calculation, and that's something that, you know, we could potentially go back and do now. So in the CQL, we could make it happen that way. If you want to actually run them as two separate services, then, you know, how do you actually indicate that his should be run first before the pain management summary? That's a more complicated orchestration issue, and it's something, quite honestly, that you know, we haven't fully solved yet in the standards world. Although, you know, there are some things like the application of BPM, which is beginning to be spoken about, that could potentially help with things like that. Another potential approach, and this is, again, not ideal, but I would anticipate might be a way that sometimes it's done, is that, you know, the MME is actually just calculated on, you know, a nightly basis or something like that as a bulk job. But again, then that would miss anything that happened during the encounter, which is not ideal.
Yeah, and my concern with you know, saying, oh, we could rewrite the CQL to include and do an explicit call, that puts a lot of onus on the development and management of these knowledge artifacts. So anytime something's new, you'd have to go back and kind of rewrite everything that maybe would use that. When I was doing some of this work, we were using kind of a more of a, you know, REIT-based execution model, using JBoss's Drools as an example, which allows you to manage that notion as states change and you have new data, it would reevaluate, you know, the availability of these CQLs as an example. It wasn't using CQL, but I think from a standards perspective, we need to figure that out, because managing, you know, updating everything once we knew something new and a new module creates is not sustainable at scale. Thank you, though.
Yeah, understood. And I think actually Ken Kawamoto has done some work, at least prototyping JBoss Drools with CQL libraries. So
awesome.
He may be able to actually speak to that.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you showing us your toys, and I think this was very helpful. It's clear that it's very targeted, but what I enjoyed seeing there is that there's a centralized, standardized way that you created here, so kudos to you.
Thank you,
thank
Chris
you.
And Sharon. We
yes.
We appreciate your time and contributions. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. I think that means, Carolyn, I think we're turning this back over to Sam and Al from ONC for discussion of some of the remaining supplemental EHR, children's EHR format requirements.
Yes, that's where we're at.
Thank you so much. As part of the agenda today, we carved out some time to really wrap up some of the work on the pediatric recommendations. And there is one outstanding item, and that was really, and we had socialized and discussed this on earlier calls, we wanted to be thorough and deliberate in asking the task force to look closely at the supplemental format items associated with, I think, the first half or so of the recommendations. On a previous call, it was recommended, as one example, I believe, for recommendation to compute weight-based drug dosage. There were supplemental children's format requirements for recommendation two. There were two identified. The second one, alert based on age-specific norms, I believe Chip had indicated that that did not belong as a supplemental. And so we wanted to provide an opportunity, if there were any supplemental children's format requirements for a correlated recommendation that folks felt should be removed from the technical worksheets at this time, to identify those. Again, just for clarity, there are 10 recommendations. We identified supplementals in the technical worksheets indicating that speaks back about the relevance of the children's EHR format requirements and their correlation to the recommendation. So if there is not a close correlation, if it is not a value to be correlated with the respective recommendation, we wanted to walk through that at this time. So this may not take very long. We just wanted to be comprehensive in our approach here. Any questions? Okay. Having
nope.
said that, so for recommendation one, there are three supplementals that were identified. Any of those that anyone would seek removal of at this time? Okay. Chris, is it okay, and Caroline, is it okay to kind of walk through them? I don't want to kind of read this out loud. I'm trusting people have kind of reviewed them prior. Does this approach work for the team?
I think it's fine for me.
It
would be nice if you could pop them up on the screen, though, I'd say.
Okay.
We don't have to read through them, but it would be nice to at least take a look at them.
Absolutely. Let's just give staff a moment to share her screen to pull up the technical worksheet document. There may be, instead of doing two screen shares, why don't we just do that as a single screenshot? I'll keep going while she pulls that up. For recommendation two, this was compute weight-based drug dosage. There are two supplementals identified here. The second one is the one that was recommended for removal.
Yeah, that's the...
Sorry, which one are you on?
We're
I just pulled up my screen now.
Sure, thanks. Sorry, Steph. It's supplemental children's format requirements for recommendation two.
Okay, got it. Thanks. Okay, hopefully that's showing up on everyone's screen.
Can you zoom in a little, Steph? The first...
Oh, yes, sure.
The first one is rounding for administratable doses, and the second one is alert based on age-specific norms, and we had the discussion that that would be too challenging to implement from the get-go.
Okay. So I believe there's consensus to remove that.
I think that's fair to say.
Okay, moving on then to recommendation three. There are four supplementals identified for recommendation three.
I missed them.
Yeah, I don't think we really didn't discuss these, well, at least one of these pretty particularly, as I recall. And because I meant that, I remember that I was going to mention something about it. If, on, what do you call it? On recommendation, on supplemental number two, about the system shall be able to track that the child's legal guardians were notified. I just wondered if we're trying to link that to some API stuff, and I just was confused by that VDT aspect of it, and the fact that you could do this with a free text field, and I don't think that's the intent of the supplemental. And then on number three. I know I've mentioned this a couple times, you know, where it says the system shall have the ability to identify members of the care team, including professional and non-professional members, and indicate their roles and relationships to the child. That's something, personally, I'm very much in favor of. That's part of the AAP's actual definition of the care plan, and it's something our customers do all the time. But there's this little... In the 2015 criterion alignment, there's the little bit about authentication and access control and authorization. And it's one thing to have a note within a chart that says the following person out here at the Lund Family Center is their care, or, you know, their social worker. She can access this. It's one thing to have that kind of note. It's another thing to expect this implementation to have discrete access control on every single element of the chart for every single person who might be able to see this chart. You've just created an exponential framework of access, and I think that's a very difficult thing not only to develop, but to create a user interface that works there. And if I'm barking up the wrong tree, just tell me to shut up.
I don't think that that is meant to actually control access. I think it's meant to be able to store the information, preferably in a structured format, but only to those people that you consider important enough. It doesn't seem to be inclusive of everybody that the chart might get in contact with.
I hope that's the case. It was just that what I wondered, as soon as I saw authentication and access control as part of the alignment, I wanted to make sure that if that's the case, we should be having a discussion about what that really means. The idea is great. The implementation is tricky. Otherwise, just having a structured format for identifying who should have authentication and who should have access control, I think I'm very much in support of that.
Thank you. These comments are very helpful. And again, much of this are related to implementation considerations to inform and shape, future work here.
That's nice of you to say. Thank you. All right. That was that last one is, though, Dr. Lehman, this is where, this is pretty tricky business. We've got some, as you know, there's just so many legal challenges to it, where it's not even known, regardless of the technology sometimes, who exactly has the ability to authorize care, release information, and authorize payment for care on behalf of the patient. And to have that be something that's automated from a technical perspective, and have whatever the system is understand child foster care, state social service agencies, guardians, guarantors. That's hard to do with a paper and pencil.
That's right. And but if you look at this, it's actually pretty non-formulaic, right? It just says that the system have the ability to store, retrieve, and display information. It doesn't say in which format, that it has to be structured data. It just has to have the ability to put this in there, as well as storing copies of relevant consent and authorization forms. I think while I perceive your concern that this might be interpreted as running full access control and being the basis for triggering decision support of who can see something and who doesn't, I don't think that's what it says.
Yeah, I very much agree with you that this doesn't say that here. I get stuck, and I'm between a recommendation that can be resolved with a free text field and a recommendation that is impossible to implement because it's too structured. And I know everyone understands the pain there.
Unfortunately, you're right. This could be theoretically resolved with a free text field. One would hope that a vendor does better than that.
Yes.
All this requirement says is you need to be able to document it and pull it back up. And, that's better than not having this information available. So I think this is a pretty basic requirement, and I'm in favor of just leaving it as is. Maybe with the idea that this is not going to drive access control and with a caveat that we don't want a free text field either.
I can certainly agree with that.
Okay, thank you. Moving on then, if that's
yes,
okay,
please.
To recommendation four supplemental stuff, if you could scroll to those. I believe there's one.
Yep. All right, that's a difficult one because while I love the notion that you could get legal advice while you're browsing in the EHR an EHR vendor, this is a real challenge because especially when it comes to the pediatric realms, we're talking 56 different local flavors of the law, right?
Yeah, and Chris, this is Al. It's a multiple of 56 because there are different ages of consent for different conditions. Reproductive health, surgical consent.
Thanks for blowing it up, Al.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I
couldn't agree more. Without an official, an approved centralized resource to do this. This is asking EHRs not to provide clinical decision support, but legal decision support, and they're even less qualified to do that than the clinical decision.
Let me ask the question: is anybody opposed to 86ing this particular requirement?
No.
This is Aaron. Let me ask a question. Is it possible to meet the criteria by referring to whatever resources may be available at the prospective hospital? So basically allowing any kind of administrator to sort of add in, okay, here's the contact information for the social work department or whatever, whoever handles it within the respective health system. Would that meet the criteria, or is the criteria specifically decision support built in within the EMR?
Well, what it does, it says, you should be able to within the EHR, to click on something, that's how I read it, and get legal guidelines on consent requirements and the age of consent for treatment, et cetera. So that becomes, to me, because the person who has to implement this is the EHR vendor, not the local practice or the local hospital, right? So it becomes a real obstacle to me. If we turn this from a shall to a may, then it has no teeth, but it shows that we still like the notion that more information for practicing clinicians is better than less information, right? But principally, I think it's not implementable as is. So what can I say that we generally like the idea, but we don't think this should be a requirement?
Anybody? I certainly don't. I totally agree. I certainly don't think we can expect the EHRs to be able to maintain this, and we're right in that funny zone of, let me put it this way. This is the unfortunate part of writing specs like this. The system shall provide the ability to access legal guidelines. That is the same thing as saying the system shall provide the ability for someone to insert a hyperlink. Because that's all they're asking for here, and so it's either saying so little that that it's not very useful, or it's asking for more than a vendor can reasonably provide.
Yeah, but the caveat here is that the hyperlink might not be relevant to the state or the age of the child or whatever. So I think we all like the general idea, but I don't think anybody thinks this is feasible.
Yep.
Okay. Moving on. Thank you, Stephen. Okay. Okay, recommendation 5, we have produce complete forms from EHR data. All right.
Did you just hear me curse before I took my phone off mute?
You know, the beauty of school forms and CAM forms is that whenever you think you have them all, there are more that you have never seen before, with more data requirements that you have never encountered.
Yeah, I worked on this particular thing quite a bit when I was participating with the model, you know, the Children's EHR Format Program. And one of the discussions we got into here was, do we want to have a requirement that indicates that the system shall produce a report with what is reasonably expected in a state's form? You know, the child's name, date of birth, sex, the date the report was produced, and the immunizations. And that's one thing. But what everyone actually really needs is for the EHRs to produce their particular state forms. And that's something else. And when those two things get conflated, it's very difficult. I will tell you that the state of Connecticut has a form that is not designed to be completed by an EHR. The state of New York has defined legislatively, they consciously did not work with any EHR vendors or any health IT professionals, and they've created a new form that is going to be required of them later this year that is also not designed to be completed by an EHR. And so I know this doesn't say you have to comply with your local state, but we have a significant problem in the pediatric IT space where that there is no commonly defined camp, school, childcare form.
Well, it would be nice if it was just the different states, but the reality is that in some states it varies by county, right?
Oh, sure. And then one of the things that we see routinely is even in those states where you have a relatively straightforward form to fill out, individual school systems within a county will interpret the completion of the form differently. And so there is not a computable, no one has developed a computable language version of a school form that's universally, or even vaguely universally acceptable. So
go ahead. Sorry.
Well, the idea that we have a requirement for a pediatric EHR to produce a document with this information here, I'm fully supportive of. And that's where we landed on, and we worked on the children's EHR form. I said, of course, a pediatric EHR needs to produce an immunization report, and this is how we can define it. We should make clear that that's different from you have to comply with some state's changing school form mandate.
Yeah.
So this is not a technically hard problem to solve. It's a business problem to solve, and I don't think the EHR is the place that we push on this. When we worked with Adobe to create the PDF healthcare format using, you know, XFA as an example, that allows you to create a standard PDF, but you can drop an XML payload in it and it fills out the form. So the technically this is very feasible, but you're right. We have to get the people creating the forms to leverage those standards, and the certification is not going to do that. So while I think this would be an extremely valuable functionality for family docs and other pediatricians, I just don't think it's feasible and therefore probably should not be included.
Well, what I heard Chip say is that this is generally a perfectly fine and it can be done, but it cannot be interpreted as it must reflect the local variation of that particular report. So with that said, I think if we keep that same clarification that was agreed upon when the EHR format was created, I think we can leave this in with the caveat that this is not something that reflects local or state forms necessarily.
Correct.
If it by accident does, that's fine. but it's not intended to substitute for local or state forms.
Yep, and I'm comfortable also saying that because the items, the elements listed here, although they're each one of them is actually in broadly interpretable, all right, you can get into a four-hour-long discussion about the format of the child's name and what elements it should include, but these are generally much more consistently accepted and developed than when a school form asks for a problem list. Because a problem list is that's a three-week discussion. And the items that are listed here, I think, are really important for patient safety and patient vaccine coverage and are generally well understood. So that's why I'm comfortable with it as this, as long as it's not part of a broader misunderstanding.
This is Aaron. I'm going to ask maybe an unpopular question, but I'm just going to ask it as with my CIO hat on. Is it possible? I agree that EMR vendors should not have to deal with local variability. I think that's a bit ridiculous given just how crazy the states are all over the map with this. Is it possible to make a requirement there that a system can be configurable to allow for a respective hospital, healthcare system, doctor, whomever, to input in a special form or a unique form that would just simply grab those data elements and add it on there? I mean, I'm thinking back to the days of you know, when you did this with PDFs and you used FDF or other language to just simply insert, you know, data behind the scenes from a SQL query. Is it possible to do that and meet the regular here versus it's not on the EMR vendor, but it's a configurable option that the respective users can do?
Yeah, I think right there what you're getting at is not a pediatric specific endeavor. I think all the specialties need that functionality, and the tricky part on the pediatric side is getting people to better define the pediatric data that they want. So that's why I kind of like this one, even though it's a pain in the butt as a vendor or as a developer. The fact that we're saying you have to produce very specifically immunization elements, and that's because that's not always well done. It's later on with the non-pediatric functionality or some of the weird pediatric functionality that some of the school forms people want, that it has nothing to do with a form and the ability to generate a form. Vendors do that all the time. We've been doing it for 30 years. It's a matter of, no, you're asking for data that you can't actually compute.
What can you give me an example? Like what is data you can't compute? What is that actually?
So for example, right now I could send you a copy of the draft New York State form that they're about to mandate. They have a box, okay, and the box is oddly shaped. It's not like your standard CMS forms where boxes line up and you know, characters are in each element. They have just a box that's probably, I've never actually measured it with a ruler, but it's probably something like 0.88 inches tall and 4.7 inches wide, and it's unevenly shaped because the title's in the middle of it, and then it just says problem list. And you have to interpret what it is that goes in that box. And so that's not a pediatric thing, and I have probably 10 different ways we could fill that problem list in there. And from a technical perspective, that's easily done. But the problem is that whatever data I put in there, I'm going to put dates in. Am I going to put the SNOMED code, or am I going to put the ICD-10 code, or am I only going to put active things, or am I going to put inactive things? And since there's only enough room maybe for three or four items, how do I rank them? I could go on and on. And so that's the stuff we're running into with forms. It's not the technical ability to extract data from the database and put it on a piece of paper. It's defining in a computable fashion what data you wish to see in there.
Yeah, this is right. That definition of that data is going to be dependent on who the requester is. You know, every camp, every university, every school district is going to have a different request of the EHR. So it's really going to be up to the requester to develop that requirement.
I understand the variability, and I get the difficulty from a development level. I totally understand that, and I totally understand the uniqueness that it's going to be depending on health system or school system or whatever. but to the degree of it, I don't like us saying that, you know, just because it's hard to do, we shouldn't do it or we should do something else. I just want us to just try to think out the box if there's something even standard we can produce, which I think is our recommendation. I just want us to be careful with that because tech can do anything. And for folks to say that, you know, it's just too difficult, there's too much variability, could lead to misinterpretation by people. That's all.
Yeah, I think the way that we frame the situation is critical because people looking at this work in the future won't necessarily have the benefit of all of our commentary and notes and understand the nuances of the conversation. So I think we do need to be careful with how we convey this.
Yeah, well said, Carolyn.
Yeah, this is Steve. One other thing, too. So the comment about saying, okay, well, these are not customizable forms, just a standard form for this data that's listed in the description, well, I think that's, you know, easily doable. Is that helpful to the pediatrician at all? If the camp physicals, the school physicals, the child care are all saying, no, you have to provide it on our form, then all we've done is created a requirement for the EHR to create a form that nobody's ever going to use. So, again, I think the notion is either we do something like was discussed here, create this as a functionality for form authorship so that you would have to, as an EHR, create an authorship environment that will allow you to create a form to replicate the whatever form is out there and tie it to data elements that are in the EHR. Therefore, then you can be able to create custom forms or to just eliminate this functionality. My concern is that the former is a little bit too big of a jump from where we're at currently. But
so being a little future looking, I know that after trying for 25 years, the AAP section on school health is pretty darn close to actually come up with something that they generally could agree upon should be on the school form. And while it will not be recognized by every county or every state or every camp, it will, if they actually publish it, it will rather quickly become something that folks kind of rally around, and there will be at least a potential template for this kind of report. So I'm thinking that we should leave this in as it is because it doesn't really put any local spin or requirement on it, and hopefully as we coalesce about common forms, the same will happen in the EHR.
I agree. The moment the Academy creates even a basic bare-bones standard school form, all the EHR vendors would need to pay attention, and then I would feel very differently about mandating a form requirement here. And I believe it made one of the top 10 ALF resolutions this spring. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That changes everything because now we can all point at one central clinical source and say, this is what you're supposed to be doing. It also gives EHR vendors the ability to push back, not on the physicians, but on the people asking for this data. Say, well, why don't we start with this document that the physicians themselves has defined as what's important? And that helps a lot. So I agree with you. By agreeing to this, we are getting partway there, and then the moment something can be well-defined, we actually can mandate it of the EHR vendors. That's my position.
All right.
Thank you. And I believe we have one more supplemental under Recommendation 7. And then, Lauren, I anticipate in the next few minutes you'll want us to turn over for public comment, and then hopefully we can still have time for Carmen to offer some remarks, and I will tee that up. So, Steph, can you pull up Recommendation 7.
Appropriate.
Yep, I agree.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Lauren, is it too soon to do public comment, or can we keep moving ahead?
Yeah, we have about 5 minutes, so if you want to keep moving.
Okay, that's great. Is it okay to proceed back to the OUD? Actually, I'm sorry. I had one brief comment. Steph, can you pull up the Pediatric Health IT Tools Resources Draft Compilation? Dr. Lehman had provided some tools, resources, information that he thought was valuable. We, in a recent AMIA article, we heard earlier from the high-tech committee on some of the Smart on Fire tools to support pediatric health IT. This is a draft document. It is a table. It's probably about 18 to 20 pages. And really what we did is compile where we were aware of federally supported sponsored resources that support pediatric health IT, and then toward the end, some developed from external stakeholders. So this was provided as an attachment. We wanted to share this. And in the event that you are aware of tools or other resources that we should integrate into this, we're happy to get that input from the task force and anticipate, you know, that this is the type of information that will obviously be supportive of some of the implementation considerations that we've heard that aligns with our approach for supporting the care continuum, and we look forward to making this more widely available. So I'm not going to take time to socialize in more than that, but that was provided as a background, and we thank you in advance if you have any ideas for us. Thank you. And, Chris, you'll find, so we did integrate in some of the content you provided to us as part of this table.
Wonderful. Thank you, Sam.
Sure. Okay, so moving on, if we can now close out of this document and pull up the slides, we should be on the Health IT and OUD RFI slide. Oh, I'm sorry. It looks like, Lauren, you want public comment.
Sorry about that. I was on mute. Why don't we go and do that now? Operator, can you open the public line?
Yes. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad, and a confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. Excuse me, comment queue. You may press star 2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. If you're using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset prior to pressing the star keys.
And do we have any comments in the queue at this time?
There are no comments at this time.
Okay, we'll check back later to give folks another minute or so. But Sam, I'll hand it back to you.
Okay, great. If we can pull up the slide, the Health IT and OUD Prevention and Treatment RFI. Okay, so we've seen this slide before. I just want to take a few seconds here. We are asking you as a task force to really provide, as Beth described last week, a value statement in general for you know, how health IT and existing and new criteria can support clinical priorities and advance interoperability for the OUD use case. And so there's some qualifiers under the general overarching question on this slide. Moving on, the next slide is, okay, we wanted to carve out time today. The first question we've shared on earlier calls, and this is really looking at effective approaches for the successful dissemination and adoption of standards, including the NCPDP script standard, as one example that can support the exchange of PDMP data for integration into EHRs and also enable and advance EPCS. We heard some background last week on these topics. And then today, I'm hoping that we can take a few minutes to look at opportunities for integration of health IT with PDMPs and EPCS and any of the real or perceived challenges from a policy or technical perspective, and then some of the health IT solutions and effective approaches to improve opioid prescribing and clinical decision support, which we had a demonstration on CDS earlier in the call. Going to the next slide. Okay, so for the next three or four slides. I'm going to hand this over to my colleague, Carmen Smiley. Carmen was able last week to have a few minutes to talk about the script standard, and we wanted to carve out some more time today for her to provide some background. I'm mindful of the time. So, Carmen, as you go through this, I'm not sure how much time we will have left for group discussion, but I would just ask that I will defer to the chair and co-chair in terms of those bulleted discussion items on that PDMP slide. Earlier, we may need to circle back to them during the next call or may have a few moments today. So, Carmen?
Thanks, Sam. So I wanted to quickly point everybody to the ONC ISA. As I believe we've done so in the past, I placed one link to one specific page on the ISA, which we typically call it, that's related to allowing a prescriber to request a patient's medication history from a PDMP. And one of the other enhancements that we've added to the ISA more recently was actually a specialty care setting and settings functionality for both opioids and pediatrics. And Al online has also helped a great deal, especially in the pediatric space. And so the examples that I'm providing below are really specific to opioids, and including so allowing a prescriber to send a prescription to a pharmacy for controlled substances, really EPCS. Drug administration events are also allowed in the 2017-071 standard, one of the many advances that we hope to be able to take advantage of as everybody is adopting the standard. Communicate with the REMS administrator is also in the MPRM, and allowing for the exchange of PDMP data across the entire ecosystem. Next slide, please. Here is what the specialty care and settings functionality looks like. And so as you look to the left side of your screen, if you, whenever you're anywhere on the ISA, you should be able to click on either the opioids button or the pediatrics button to view some of the pages that are specific to that use case or care setting. Next slide, please. And this is the ISA page that I refer to about allowing for the exchange of PDMP data across the entire ecosystem. This is, like all of our ISA pages, a work in progress. And we welcome public comment on all of our ISA pages throughout the year. We do publish a standard reference edition of the ISA at the end of each year that compiles all of the public comments, considers them, and integrates them into the published form on the website. And so, of course, we would welcome any comments from anybody on the line. But as you can see, it lists the script standard 10.6, the standard that everybody is currently certified to as part of the ONC certification program. The 2017-071 standard immediately below that is the standard that is outlined in the MPRM. The NCPDP telecommunications standard is also involved between at a different part of the ecosystem that is primarily communicating between pharmacies and the PDMPs, or between pharmacies and prescription drug management systems. NEEM is actually a data standard that is used for interstate exchange, as is PMIX. ASAP is another widely utilized standard, though it is not an ANSI-accredited standard. It has been widely utilized across the ecosystem. And HL7 version 2, and the one emerging standard I would like to point everybody to is the US Meds STU2. We hope to support, of course, adoption of everybody towards FHIR that would support the exchange of information that is system agnostic. Next slide, please. Specific to EPCS, we understand that the DEA currently tests the systems that they certify for EPCS to 10.6 per script. We're hoping to find out soon as to when they also plan to upgrade their system to test other HIT systems to become certified specifically for EPCS to the 2017-071. I also point out that NCPDP just released their PDMP reporting standard implementation guide. So it's been developed for the use of BAT electronic submission, primarily between dispensers or pharmacies and PDMPs. I know the last time we had a call, somebody had requested perhaps a minimum data set or a normalized standard between everybody. This is one of the best, I feel, one of the best routes towards that goal. Did somebody have a question? I'm sorry, it must have been feedback. And also over the years, script schemas have been updated support, digital signature indicators, controlled substance indicators, drug abuse treatment indicators, and as well as additional support for prescriber identification. We've not talked about patient matching or provider directories much, but of course we want to support the advancements of standards to help support connection and identity management across systems. That might be my last slide. Is there an additional slide? There is not.
Thank you, Carmen. Questions for Carmen?
No, none for me, thanks.
Can we pull up the slide, I believe it's the next electronic prescribing and PDMP slide that has the discussion sub-bullets? I think we need to go back a few slides. Thank you. Okay. So I'm not sure we'll have time for robust discussion, but just a general sense in the last, Chris and Caroline, if there's 2 or 3 minutes of thoughts you'd like to facilitate for the group for these discussion items on this topic.
And I think we're kind of at the end of the hour, so I'm not sure how productive it will be. But the agenda is to discuss what we just heard and see what perceived challenges or opportunities we see with PDMP and EPCS. In the integration, and you know, I would love to hear, especially from people that are involved in building this technology and integrating it, if they see any significant obstacles to that. I'm just gonna ask Chip. I know this is not your area of domain work because you were mainly focused on the pediatric end, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts to that.
Well, I'm going to share the slide with one of my colleagues here. PCC is, we've had to do some pretty serious amping up of our ERX development work in the last couple months, and will be for a little bit. And so I have some people here who are very interested in this topic and can speak to it much more accurately than I ever could. So I'd hoped actually one of them would be able to be on the phone call today for public comment, but this would have occurred after public comment, so and she wasn't able to make it anyway. So I was just going to share this information with her because I think they'd have some really well-educated understanding of this, but much certainly more so than I. So that's my hope to have some feedback for you shortly.
Yeah. Chris, my comment, while I understand from a policy perspective how we got to where we're at, technically I just don't understand why we didn't lever the highly adopted ERX infrastructure to do this messaging about opioids, and why we have a separate whole nother set of standards and transactions to deal with opioid status, where the med history that's being implemented through standards based in the Surescripts network is already integrated into EHRs.
That's a great question. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I'm sorry to interrupt. This is Carmen Smiley again. I just wanted to address your concern. And so they are actually utilizing the script standard, including SureScripts uses a slightly artisanal version of the standard. They test above and beyond the ONC certification requirements, but it is because of the script standard and it is because of the existing infrastructure that we are striving to utilize precisely what we have. Now, is it perfect? It is not, but we're certainly working towards harmonization and again, utilization of all of the resources that are already in place.
Okay. I think we are at the actually over time, so I'm going to turn it back to Sam and see if she wants to close that off. Or see if Carolyn has something she wants to add.
No, I just think that this the discussions that we had today and the presentations have given us a lot to think about, and perhaps we will want to take some time to revisit this most recent discussion started by Carmen next week. At least from my perspective, it's a lot to absorb all at once, and I should probably review the slides and think about it some more.
Thank you. Lauren, did you want to offer public comment, or did we need to close out?
Sure. Let's just check one more time. Operator, do we have any comments in the queue?
No comments in the queue at this time.
Okay. Well, with that, I want to thank Carmen and the other ONC staff, and thank Chris and Susan for joining us today. Otherwise, I don't have anything else, and I think we can adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.